get us working.
Okay, hi. I'm welcome to Thresholds, Raw. I'm for everyone joining us, I'm here in the cafe at the Midland Hotel in Manchester with Comma Press publisher and editor Raw Page. Raw, thanks for coming along for coffee. Nice to have you here. What really interests me about Comma Press is that you've been this innovative, groundbreaking force for short stories, both here in Manchester, in the UK, and actually, internationally as well. Tell me a little bit about how it came into being.
Well, it started in Manchester. I was working as a journalist for a magazine that was kind of Manchester's version of Time Out, a magazine called City Life. And I was reviewing a lot of books for national newspapers as well, and interviewing lots of writers. And as I interviewed them and got to know them, I discovered that a lot of them were very established as novelists, but were predisposed to write short stories, and sort of wrote short stories as a passion, but were unable to get them published anywhere. This was sort of late 90s.
Right.
And so with the magazine that I was working for, I commissioned a series of little sort of free fiction supplements, commissioned Manchester writers to write like 6 short stories per supplement set in Manchester. And then I repeated the project in Liverpool, Leeds and Newcastle with 3 magazines in those cities. The idea initially was to give platform to writers writing outside of London, writing about northern urban landscapes. And
that seemed quite important to you, obviously, to break out, to have sort of a kind of good publisher that was breaking out of London?
Absolutely. Publishing not through any sort of malicious trait or any kind of deliberate design, but publishing is a very centralised business, and like any kind of national media, it sort of tests its product in London, and if it works amongst editors or readers in London, then they just roll it out for the rest of the country. And
right.
That's how everything works. Music works that way, TV works that way, obviously. And I was keen to give alternatives to that. I'm very interested when I read, if I'm reading Death in Venice or a book about a specific place, to then relate that to the real place, because you get lots of versions of the same place. There's within your own life, when you go somewhere as a child, it's a different place than when you go there as an adult. And likewise, in text, that landscape is very different. It's the same landscape, but it's also completely separate. So I was interested at the time with the way cities were portrayed by their writers, and kind of increasing the number of different versions available to readers of those cities in fiction.
Right, so you really sort of blazed a trail here in Manchester and in the north of England generally. Thinking about all the stories that come across your desk, what is it that keeps you reading a short story? You've looked at thousands, thousands. So, what is it that makes either a Raw Page short story or a Comma Press short story, or simply something that you think is a great story that transcends all those things?
Well, it's easy for me to say, but it's not very useful for writers listening. Basically, I want to be surprised. I want something to strike me as different. We have sort of coverage and narratives of all different perspectives and stories in quotes presented to us through mainstream publishing and through the media, and you kind of those presentations become very, very quickly meaningless. So I'm really interested in sort of authentic voice, but then again, that's a very dangerous thing to try and encourage people to engineer, because you can't engineer an authentic voice.
No, and you can't engineer a surprise.
Yes, exactly.
That's the thing, isn't it? So it's sort of it's quite ineffable in a way, isn't it?
It's a bit like in Jonathan Swift's Gulliver's Travels, there's these professors in Lilliput in the University of Lugardo who set about trying to build houses from the roof downwards. Starting with the ridge plate on the roof and then building downwards. It's like that with it's like reverse engineering surprise or horror or revelation or twist. It's very, very, very difficult. So it's incredibly difficult to try and teach people how to do it. What you have to do is try and sort of teach yourself how to recognize it. Recognize it as an idea and filter out the other filter it from the rest.
So how did you teach yourself? Because I mean, your background, you did physics and philosophy.
Yeah.
At Oxford. So not the most conventional route into literary publishing.
Sure.
So how were you always a massive reader?
I wasn't a massive reader. That was the point. So I was encouraged to do sciences as a kid, but I did an MA. I deliberately did an MA in English at Manchester University,
right,
to try and force myself back into reading and catching up, because I knew I'd missed so much. I'm a slow reader. There's huge gaps in my reading still. So I'm not a natural English person at all, English literature person at all. But I think that's quite an interesting thing about the short story. The short story sort of provides lots of entry points to writers who are not naturally your average English literature graduate. Lots of strange and interesting writers have entered into the kind of literary bloodstream through the short story. If you think about somebody like Primo Levi, who was a chemist, he wrote the most fabulous short stories that are just models of how to write great short stories. I reread Magic Paint recently, which is just the perfect short story in a way.
Wow.
And there were, if you look at a lot of sort of Eastern Bloc Soviet writers, people like Stanislav Lem that I've done a big project on, he was a writer who was able to straddle lots of different disciplines. He was he was mathematically minded, he trained as a doctor, he was obsessed with physics and robots and mechanisms, and he was very sort of, in our view, a very scientifically minded person, but he was also this great comic, this great poet, etc., etc. And you can move between these disciplines in the form of the short story. It's a very mobile sort
it is,
of form.
Yeah, it's very mutable.
It's
very receptive to hybrids,
yeah,
to
exactly.
invention.
Exactly. It's one of those forms that can sustain conceits which couldn't last the length of a novel. It's like a balancing act, a juggling act,
sure,
or some kind of performance. It can only last so long, and the short story is the length that it can sort of survive in.
Yeah, thinking about the length and endings, I think I'm right in remembering, Raoul, that you once said, before I ever met you, you said this thing that really stayed with me, that you think, you know, the ending of a short story should be a beautiful thing, and that you described it as, it should almost, you know, sort of have an energy about it, like the snapping of a rubber band, and you said you wanted to take the skin off the end of your fingers.
I don't remember saying that, but no.
Let me put words into your mouth.
Yeah, no, it sounds a reasonable idea.
Do you love the ending? I mean, do you love a short story ending? Is that something you can feel? Is it quite visceral, or?
Yeah, it's a snap of realization, really. It's a snap of, like, you realize you've been misdirected. In a way, everything in a short story leads towards an ending, but it points the other way, so you don't realise it's, in a good short story, you don't realise it's leading towards this ending, and the ending is, the whole thing is an ending in a way, or a change, which is a kind of an ending, and everything is kind of like waiting for this other story to drop into place, and you don't know this story is waiting in the wings, this second story, this backstory, this revelation, so you're constantly being misdirected. And then in hindsight, and it's only in hindsight when this revelation happens and the whole thing snaps shut, it's only in hindsight that you realise this ending was inevitable. But until that point, you've been misdirected and thought that you were reading a different kind of story. A classic example of this is like Carver's The Cathedral, where you think you've got this character who's very sort of unsympathetic and insensitive towards his blind guest, and then suddenly you have this moment of union and this moment of congress and contact between two people, two souls that you didn't think could happen. Joyce is the best at this in terms of turning the whole story around in the last few sentences, or sometimes even just after the very last full stop, you realise the whole story has just turned on you, and it's a completely different story, and you have to sort of process it and reprocess it in the light of this of this real ending and this other version of the story that's dropped into place. So
that's a brilliant description. And Joyce, in terms of like revelation, he talks about the, I always love that phrase, that the revel, he says, you know, the, in terms of what, you know, we now call the epiphany or the revelation of the whatness of the thing. I think Joseph O'Connor, and talking about Joyce, said that Joyce had these sort of glimpses of the miraculous that came through in those moments. So it's but that's probably really different from that misdirection that you're talking about. It's not a sort of twist in the tail, though, is it?
No, a twist in the tail seems very throwaway, and it's a commercial term. Yeah. It refers to a sort of commercial type of fiction, but it's a twist, or it's a revelation. I think it's actually the same thing. It's just that in our sense of twist in the tail stories, the turn or the revelation happens outside in the world of facts and events. So you think of it, the revelation there is in the plot. Suddenly realised that it was a different killer. The murderer was somebody who was close to the, you know, you thought was a friend or an ally. It's that kind of external twist. But in Joyce and in Carver and in Chekhov and all these great modernist short story writers, it's the same process. But the twist is to do with the internal drama. It's inside the realm of the interior space or the character. So the twist is not that this person that you thought was a good guy is actually a bad guy or whatever in a classic sort of twisty drama, Sherlock Holmes drama or something, but it's that there's a twist and a turn in the way that you thought that character behaved and saw the world. You think you know the character, you're inside the interior world of this character, and then suddenly you are shocked, and perhaps even the character themselves is shocked by who they really are. So I'm thinking of, like, a classic example is Joyce's Eveline, where you think this woman is going to leave, and all her life she's been wanting to escape, and she gets this chance to escape, and then, I'm going to spoil the story. Well, I'll let you read it, but there's a twist, there's a turn, and it's not like a plot twist, it's a revelation about
it's a revelation,
her,
yeah.
about her soul. But it's the same principle, it's just, with the modernist stories, all of these dramas happen within the central character, within their head, within their emotional landscape. And with the old traditional short stories, they would just be with regard to who did what.
It's a plot thing, as you say. And I think when you were saying earlier that the revelation, once you arrive at it, you're surprised, but it also seems inevitable.
Yeah.
And that, for me, too, is the difference between maybe what can at times in some stories be quite a kind of creaking twist in the tail.
Yeah.
It seems those kinds of twists seem imposed simply at the end, almost like a bit of a gimmick or a bit of a cheat.
It has to be a revelation of what you've been looking at,
a reveal
of what you've been looking at already, but a surprising reveal. So. If it's, you know, the classic story of, you know, suddenly, and then he woke up and it was all a dream, or some kind of twist which is just adding new information and just turning things around by presenting other facts which aren't relevant to what you've read already, that's not really, that's a throwaway twist, that's not a revelation.
Sure.
It's got to be a re-illumination of everything you've been looking at up until this point.
That's a fantastic phrase. A re-illumination. Okay. That's a raw page. You heard it here. Raw. You mentioned the Stanislaw Lem collection project that came out a month or so ago.
Yeah.
And Comma Press has developed this fantastic name for creating these innovative new projects, commissioning writers around certain themed collections. That's quite unusual these days, to be commissioning as much as Comma does, and to be creating these really very inventive projects. Is that an ongoing part of your work? Is that part of Comma Press's identity?
Absolutely. It's a continual struggle to either keep writers' sort of palette fresh and keep them sort of re-exploring their main themes from different angles, and it's also a struggle. It's also important to give writers an ongoing platform to be published, uh, to be publishing their short stories. So it's something which is useful when developing a writer who's maybe putting together their first book or putting together their second book or whatever between these books to keep them on task and also to challenge them to do something slightly different. But it's also about bringing new readers or different readers to the short story. So we might do some science related projects which will bring in, you know, non-humanities readers, if you like.
Right.
We may do some horror or genre-based anthologies, which again is bringing in genre readers to literary short stories. And you know, we are using very, very literary writers. We're not using sort of pulp fiction writers at
right.
all.
So that's part of Colmar's identity.
Yeah,
it's really kind of literary, inventive.
Or, yeah. And as I say, the short story is this passport which can take writers and can take readers into different areas. So the anthologies are, and these strange commissions are about giving the writer the freedom to move elsewhere. And some writers, you think they're so good at what they do, they don't need to be commissioned or to be given some weird, strange commission from me where they have to meet a scientist or whatever. But some writers respond to that, some of them don't. But I always get to the point sometimes with writers who, you know, I'm at this stage with Hassan, who is this Iraqi writer, who sometimes they just say I'm kind of repeating what I'm doing. I need to do something different.
Uh-huh.
And then I just come along and go, okay, here's a list of random commissions that, you know, anthologies that I'm putting together
yeah.
at some point. And it just allows them to go, okay, right, this gives me. And what the good thing about it is it gives them an opportunity to come at their same subject, because often they're attacking the same issue again and again and again. But it gives them a new way in, or
sure.
a new approach, a new kind of direction.
Yeah, no, it can really be galvanizing, you know, to have this new ingredient in the mix. So, you know, you sort of, maybe at a certain stage, come to know yourself or your territory in a way, but then it's the stuff of fiction to be given something completely new and out of the blue, and to work to that surprising subject, and it brings out what's probably really you, but it also brings out new stuff for you as
and
a writer.
I think it is to do with the notion of realism, really. Realism to be, you know, it's an old cliche, but to get to a certain level of truth, you can't just state the facts. You can't just write pure realism. You have to go beyond realism sometimes. You have to go into surrealism, or you have to go into magic realism, or you have to bring in some other constraint or discipline or frame or conceit. Often it's just a conceit to actually get beyond, because we're so immune to presentations of realism. It doesn't mean anything.
Exactly,
to
it
us.
Becomes so over familiar.
Yeah, yeah.
So is that also, would you say that's also part of sort of Colmar Press's identity? I mean, obviously a lot of your writers will be brilliant realist writers, or they'll work across a range, but for Colmar that's part of your your sort of driving force, is to kind of keep fiction fresh by encouraging this kind of experimentation.
Absolutely, the short story is an artificial form, and key to the idea of a short story, it sort of pretends to be, you know, even in the M.R. James sense, which is quite a traditional, old-fashioned writer.
Yeah.
He would start his stories and say, "This is a story which I was told, and I'm now telling it to you, my audience, in front of you." And there will be this sort of pretense of a live act or a live performance in the openings of his stories, and Poe would talk about this as well, where the whole thing is a sort of fictional utterance.
Mm.
So as a speech act, or as a pretend speech act.
It's like live, it's live.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But it's completely artificial.
Yeah.
And it's aware of it's aware of its artificial. It should be aware of its artificial. It should be prepared to embrace this artificiality, and that's where the sort of experimenting comes in, and the non-realism comes in. I hate the phrase magic realism, and I do apologize.
So do most so-called magic realists.
Yeah, please edit that bit out. I do apologize for using it.
But it is an artificial construct. The sense of it being live as you read, and something that's unfolding for you, sort of, you know, almost between your fingertips as you turn the pages, and that is the effect you want to create. But I find that really interesting, because while that's absolutely right, as a writer, when you're writing it, I always think it feels like a kind of, more so than when writing, say, a chapter of a novel, a short story feels like this wet clay pot on a potter's wheel, and that you're you're constantly trying to hold it and to see what shape it will take, but you can't predict that shape as you're writing, less so with a short story than perhaps other forms. So it's this kind of wet shape of clay, and you're moulding it as fast as you can as you're writing. So it's interesting that you've sort of singled that quality out. And it is, of course, something that you try to create, but it's also something of the form itself that I find fascinating about, and was the wetness of the clay as you're working with it.
Yeah.
It's hard to sort of say any other ways.
It's a great image. A writer that I was really, really keen on as I set up Comet was a sort of friend of mine called and a fantastic writer, Gerard Woodward. And his poetry, he's mainly a poet, and he's recently last 10 years moved into novels. His poetry is all about the domestic space and sort of deconstructing the domestic space. He looks at the most boring, most familiar landscapes imaginable, and he just sort of, to use a really bad metaphor, he just sort of puts it in a different light, or he turns a red light on, he turns the whole thing upside down, or he just looks at it from a slightly different angle, and suddenly it's the most alien landscape you could ever imagine.
Wow.
It's twice as alien. And this is what Kafka did, and this is what all great short story writers do. They just take the familiar,
mundane.
Absolutely. And you only need to do one thing. You don't need to jazz it up with lots of strange things. You just need to tweak one tiny thing, just tilt it, and suddenly it's a different universe. It's a million miles away, and everything about it is sort of terrifying and strange and remarkable and amazing. And all you're looking at is what was there in the first place.
Yeah.
Nothing has really changed. It's just you've put different glasses on.
Yeah, no, I could really feel that. Especially in the Comma Press, the new uncanny.
Yeah.
That's, that was a sort of masterpiece in the mundane, story after story, but the mundane just sort of turns on itself slightly.
Because the mundane is the thing which has most threat to us, because it's the closest to us.
To home, it's the closest to home.
Absolutely.
So, other writers, you mentioned Gerard Woodward, writers, short story writers working at the moment, you really admire, you're interested in?
I've always been a big fan of Jeremy Dyson. I've not published him as much as I'd like to. There's loads of writers.
Yeah.
James Salter, Eka Carrot, I'm a massive fan of Eka Carrot. There's a Bulgarian writer, Georgi Gospodinov, that I'm a big fan of. There's so many. I'm a big fan of the Stugatsky brothers, who don't write short stories so much, but wrote some fantastic novels. But there's too many. But the one I'm always proselytizing about within Comma's ranks is Hassan, because everyone knows, some of our other UK writers like David Constantine and Adam Marek. But we have this writer, Hassan Blasim, who is an Iraqi refugee based in Finland, who is just the most remarkable writer. It's just pure luck. Just, I've been the jammiest editor imaginable to be able to come across this guy and translate him for the first time into English.
Wow,
and be his only publisher.
And his collection's had a lot of acclaim, I think.
Yeah. It's a very short collection, and he's working on all kinds of other projects. And he's a filmmaker by trade. And he's a very filmic writer, but I just think it's the start of so much. I'm very, very excited about what he's going to do and where he's going to go with his work.
Controversial question, maybe. Somebody once said to me, Comma Press, in terms of what it does, it's certainly, the argument was certainly more geared towards male writers. Any thoughts?
Today we're launching Zoe Lambert's first collection. Next year we have a collection from Sarah Maitland, a collection from Jane Rogers.
It's pretty mixed.
Yeah, it is pretty mixed. We've just done this science book, Litmus, which was mainly women.
Really?
I have to say.
Obviously I know the collection.
You should read it, it's great. No, there's 17 writers in there. I think there's probably 5 or 6 men. It's many more women than.
Oh, right.
In terms of the writers, a lot of the scientists are male.
Sure.
Inevitably, it's
sure.
One of those things, but,
I
think I'm fascinated by. It's a fair claim saying that we have been male dominated in terms of some of the early rights that we snapped up, and the press was built around David Constantine's first book. He's the reason why Comma exists.
Right.
And I did bring in a lot of writers, a lot of poets as well to the stable, so there are a number of men in there. But we developed Jean Spracklin, we published her stuff, and Polly Clark, so yeah.
Fantastic.
I'm redressing that imbalance, so.
He's mentioned poets, you brought in quite a few poets. For you, you know, is that a sort of natural relationship, or quite, you know, between the poem and the short story, is that...
They're both kind of, as I say, they're both conceits and they're both artificial. So I think, the novel.
Although what isn't, I suppose.
The novel is a conceit, but the novel gives the writer time to reflect and have sort of side alleyways of thought and go off in digressions and diversions, and it allows it's a more natural way of thinking as a narrative voice, whilst. The short story and the poem have to be tight. They have to be unnaturally tight, and everything is moving within them. There are a series of cogs.
No introspection, really.
Yes,
it's complete movement. It's like film. It's all motion.
Absolutely. And you just have to. You can't have any longers. You can't have any long pauses. You can't have introspection, as you say. You can't have. Everything is like a thriller or whatever. Everything has to be doing something, moving, misdirecting, but also laying some other truth, which will hook up to the ending in the end. So everything is working really, really hard. It's doing four jobs at once. I'm a big fan of Moby Dick, which is the opposite of short story.
Yeah.
But a kind of a philosophy in Moby Dick, or a kind of a theme or motif, is the way in which everything has three or four purposes. So Queequeg's coffin was the raft which kept Ishmael alive. Everything has about four different uses.
Yeah.
And it's that mutability of use. It applies to the sort of the piecing together the components of a short story or a poem. And I'm not sure that's true of novels.
Right. Interesting. Just to kind of work you a bit harder. You're quite a hands-on editor.
It depends.
Depends on the writer.
Yeah, no, it depends on the project. So.
Depends on the project. Right. I find that interesting because just the way different editors edit and the way they work.
Yeah. If there's a project which has a brief and if there's a task, like a baseline task that needs to be done, then I will get involved. Like one of our writers had a science DNA problem to get across to the audience, and in this litmus book, and that went through three or four drafts.
So the litmus was the science collection.
So that will take a lot of involvement. Somebody like David Constantine, I don't want to move a comma.
Right.
I don't want to suggest a semicolon because it is because it's wrought in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
The whole thing comes out complete, and you can see that it's come.
That
comes
has
out
its integrity. Yeah, it's integrity.
But writers write in different ways.
Yeah.
Some writers write quite novelistic short stories. In that, they pack in a lot.
Yeah.
Like Zoe's new book has taken 4 years of editing.
Right.
But that's partly because there's so much research in there. It's 15 different stories about 15 different wars, effectively set all over the world. Across the 20th century, an immense amount of research.
Yeah.
It's a colossal achievement of hers. There's about 10 times worth of research that there would be in a normal historical novel.
Sure.
In there. There's so much to kind of move around and get right in terms of balancing dramatic motion and the development of the story, the pace of the story. And balancing that against kind of not showing your research, but embedding it naturally and digesting the research.
You can't just
regurgitate it. So it's a huge amount of work, that's kind of like one of the hardest books that's been put together with Common, because of the quantity, vast quantity of research and sort of historical material that's gone into it. So it depends on the project. Some writers like. Feedback and editing. Some writers, with a short story, they can do it. They can just write, 25 short stories, and I'll just pick my favourites.
It
works differently.
I bet.
But when it's a specific anthology around a theme, it needs to do the thing that it says on the cover.
Yeah, yeah.
Otherwise, readers get very angry.
Comma has the support of, you know, leading writers like A.S. Byatt, Hanif Qureshi, which is, you know, a fantastic accolade in itself. Mm. In terms of staying afloat financially, independent publisher,
yeah.
How are you doing it? How have you pulled off this sort of this conjuring trick?
For many years we survived on what's a type of arts council funding, which is called G4A or GFTA, which is Grants for the Arts funding, which is a very precarious way of existing as an organisation. It's just a project by project fund. So we were putting bids, which we wouldn't know whether or not we'd get them, for like 10 books at a time, and it was very, 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 very precarious. But this year, we took some time off to put in a huge bid with the Arts Council. We thankfully became MPO, which is their regular client, so we became a national portfolio organisation.
Wow, that's major.
Yeah, it gives us a bit of space to plan things, because it was always flying by the seat of our pants, sort of, and never knowing if we were going to be still in existence in a year's time. But that's still the case. It's now just 3 years' time. short fiction is a niche publishing, a niche area of publishing. It's a niche art form. It's like poetry. It's never going to be commercial. It's never going to be commercially sustainable on its own. Like ballet or like theatre or like so many other art forms, it will require, and it always has required, subsidy from the Arts Council. And long may that continue, he says nervously. No complaints so far.
Well, I'm glad, you know, Comma's still there in the fray, in the thick of it, still alive and kicking.
Just.
It's a brilliant thing. Rob Page, from Thresholds, from our listeners, our readers, thanks ever so much.
Thank you, Alison.